A shortage of healthcare workers is hitting rural hospitals hard. We're talking about what Wisconsin is doing on this front. It is The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Across the country, thousands of hospitals are inundated with critically ill patients. Here's President Biden yesterday addressing the nation, preparing hospitals for what is coming in this surge.
I directed the Pentagon to mobilize an additional 1,000 troops to be deployed to help staff local hospitals and expand capacity. That's 1,000 military doctors, nurses, and medics.
How is your healthcare team holding up? It's 800-642-1234. Michael Carney is Interim Assistant Chancellor for Strategic Partnerships and Program Development at UW-Eau Claire. Michael, welcome to the Ideas Network.
Good morning. Thanks for the invitation.
Good morning. We also have Dr. Tim Nelson here, Research and Innovation Director for the Mayo Clinic Health System in Northwest Wisconsin. Dr. Nelson, welcome to you.
Good morning.
Good morning. Dr. Nelson, let's start with you. You heard President Biden's remarks there from yesterday, preparing to send in troops, more troops to build and support for these hospital care teams in the midst of this surge. What do you make of this move?
Well, COVID has been unprecedented for us in healthcare. Mayo Clinic hospitals have been operating at or near capacity for months. And in recent weeks, we've seen an increase in the number of COVID-19 patients needing our care. And the number is expected to elevate. So clearly we need to continue to focus on the vaccines and the boosters and preventing the spread as best we can. These vaccines are safe and effective at preventing severe disease. And we need multiple other avenues in the short term and long term to continue to battle this ongoing pandemic.
And we're going to look at those avenues as well from this grant. But Michael, I want to get your reaction from your perspective on the education side. When you see mobilizing military medical personnel for hospitals that need staffing help ASAP, what is your reaction?
Well, my reaction is it reinforces the importance of the grant that we received in educating more nurses to be deployed into the field. At UW-Eau Claire, we admit many more students to our university who want to be nurses, but are unable to complete the program simply because we don't have enough capacity to teach them and to place them in a clinical setting. So the grant's really going to help us find a new way to graduate and educate a larger number of nurses who can fill these frontline positions.
Unpack the grant for us here. This is a $9.4 million over 3 years, a workforce innovation grant.
Yeah, so it's a grant that's built on basically four pillars. And when we designed our proposal, we were looking at meeting immediate critical workforce needs, such as nurses, teachers, social workers, but also looking ahead to emerging needs. And we can talk about that a little bit later in terms of a new healthcare delivery model involving care coaches. Mm-hmm. But we also wanted to look a little bit more forward to think down the road, because it's likely that this pandemic won't be the last sort of upset that we encounter. And we were imagining developing curriculum in innovation and design thinking that would better prepare our students who are graduating and our business owners in the region to be able to more quickly pivot in response to, you know, whatever is coming down the pipe in the future.
Dr. Nelson, you know, these students, they need their clinicals in the hospital setting, the clinic setting, and regardless of whether they're nurses or another aspect of the healthcare team, they need that hands-on training. And you can't just flood your floors with student nurses. How do you handle many more students doing clinicals?
Yeah, you're spot on. This is a challenge that we're all facing. Our traditional model of medical education that I went through as a medical student and resident is see one, do one, teach one, and that becomes the proficiency. And see one and do one is not so easy to do anymore with the pandemic, with shortage of healthcare workers, with more acuity of care in our patients, not even being able to have visitors. We can't have students in our high acuity needs of healthcare. So clearly we have to do it differently. And this grant allows us to start imagining and doing things differently with more simulation. This is definitely a future trend that we can get better and better at. And this gives us, with the partnership with University of Wisconsin Eau Claire and our staff in Northwest Wisconsin out of Eau Claire, we can start doing simulations and real live testing, if you will, for some of these skill sets that we traditionally had to do in the bedside in front of the patient. So simulation is going to be a really big focus for us as we go forward.
If you're just joining us, we're talking with Dr. Tim Nelson there, Research and Innovation Director for the Mayo Clinic Health System in Northwest Wisconsin. Michael Carney is here, Interim Assistant Chancellor for Strategic Partnerships and Program Development at UW-Eau Claire, as we discuss pipelines to address the healthcare worker shortage now and in the future. You can join in with what your clinic is facing, your hospital is facing, what you see as part of your healthcare team, 800-642-1234. So pillar number one of this grant is addressing the workforce shortage, and it specifically talks, Michael, about admitting 48 more nursing students per year, dozens of seats. I would imagine is very difficult to do if you don't have the nursing faculty to teach the classes. So isn't there a shortage of advanced degree nurses in education? How do you scale up like that?
That's an excellent point and an excellent question. And another part of our pillar is creating an online degree. It's a master's degree in nurse education. And so we're converting that curriculum to an online format, which will make it more available and accessible to folks throughout the region. But we're also providing tuition support for those students who want to become nurse educators, who have a bachelor's degree and are interested in getting this master's degree. And our hope is that that tuition support and the access to the online degree will educate more nurse educators, because you're right, we face a shortage. It's difficult to find trained master's or PhD qualified educators to teach the next generation of nurses. But we think that this grant is going to at least help us to create a stronger pipeline of future nurse educators.
And when you say tuition incentives, what does that really mean?
It means that we are going to basically provide them tuition support up to and including the full cost of their tuition, with the expectation, with the understanding that they will teach for us in the future for 2 years, or they will then be asked to pay back their tuition that they received. And this is a model that is not new. We've been using it for our Doctor of Nursing Practice students. It's a way to incentivize students to pursue this sort of degree.
Another issue is that nursing faculty who have these advanced degrees, they can often make more in the private sector. Is the faculty pay an issue?
It is. And there is initiatives ongoing that is trying to find ways to bridge that compensation gap between what a nurse can earn on the outside, sort of outside the university, and what a nurse can earn as a faculty member. But I will say that's not an uncommon situation to face within a university setting. There are many professors who are not earning what they could earn in our academic departments, earning at the university what they could earn on the outside. So it's sort of a life choice. I mean, do you want to be on the front line in on the outside in private industry, or would you prefer to have an impact on teaching the next generation? So there is a trade-off there, and it is something that is maybe perhaps more acute in nursing right now, because there is a very significant pay gap between what you earn at a university and what you can earn on the outside. But it's not uncommon within a university setting.
Dr. Nelson, I want to get you in here for clinical teams. How big of an issue is student debt and the cost of schooling to get the credentials, to be on the healthcare team, to ultimately one day work for Mayo and then pay off those student loans?
Yeah, student loans are always a big thing for all of us in many areas, but it's also a pathway that we have to go through to do the jobs that we love to do. And I think the being on a healthcare team and being able to make the impact that we do every day in the lives of our patients is a real honor and privilege. And we really get to work with some of the most amazing teams I can possibly imagine in this profession. And it's a real true honor and privilege to do what we do. And we need to inspire others to want to be part of this profession. It hasn't gotten easier in the last 2 years to be part of these teams, but it has, it continues to be an extremely rewarding profession.
Physician scientist Tim Nelson leads research for the Mayo Clinic Health System in Northwest Wisconsin. Michael Carney leads program development partnerships at UW-Eau Claire. When did the workforce shortage become especially acute at your hospital? What was done about it? Have you been exhausted after your shift only to return to the floor merely hours later to fill in the schedule gaps? Join in on the healthcare side, 800-642-1234. We'll pick this up in a minute on the Ideas Network. We're discussing the healthcare workforce in crisis on the morning show. I'm Kate Archer Kent. President Biden addressing the nation yesterday.
Our doctors, nurses, hospital staffs have gone above and beyond during this pandemic. The strain and stress is real. I really mean it. It's real. And we'll have their backs, though. We have to let them know we have their backs.
What aspect of the shortage should Wisconsin focus on? What new solutions is your hospital trying in order to fill positions and have the backs of your clinicians? What's working? 800-642-1234. UW-Eau Claire's Michael Carney is Interim Assistant Chancellor for Strategic Partnerships. Dr. Tim Nelson leads research for Mayo Clinic Health System Northwest Wisconsin Region. They're with us for about 9 more minutes. Let's bring on a caller. Colin is with us from Wausau. Hi, Colin. What would you like to bring up?
Thanks so much for taking the call and this topic. I'm actually a teacher, but kind of a similar situation. We have a shortage in the rural setting. And also, too, we do not get a lot of student teachers in the rural setting because they have to pay an extra cost to leave the university's kind of mileage radius area to then do a student teaching to have a professor come and check them out. So wondering if there are incentives in the medical field that to be a nurse, to be a doctor in a rural setting that would maybe pay back your loans, and or if there's a fee for somebody to go do a clinical or an observation in a rural setting that the university isn't going to tack on more money or more cost to that university student for doing that.
Colin, great question. Michael Carney, you first.
We currently don't charge students extra for their clinical experience for nurses in their clinical setting. So that's not an extra burden that we place on our students.
What about you, Dr. Nelson, in terms of getting those clinicals that are maybe a ways away for the student who really wants to be able to one day practice in a rural setting, but their med school or their school is in a very urban area?
Yeah, it's a great question. So there have been longstanding programs from state and federal agencies and to offset the tuition costs that you've acquired during your medical training if you go and spend X amount of time in a rural setting. These are very popular programs and have been really important to address the issue that's being raised here. In addition to that, there's other things we have to bring to the table. Mayo Clinic is a nationwide health system in Rochester to Jacksonville, Florida to Scottsdale, Arizona. And in Northwest Wisconsin, we have a tremendous training opportunity in family medicine and primary care where we recruit students from across the enterprise to Eau Claire to get them exposed to the joys and the struggles, but the joys as well of rural communities. And we think that with technology and new programs and new ways of doing our work, we think we can help make those rural jobs more appealing. I don't think there's anything more gratifying than be really embedded in a community and be a key piece of that community. That's what my stepfather was as a physician growing up. And I think we have to find ways of making this more appealing. Financially, it's not going to be the solution only, but that does have to be a part of it.
Part of this grant, Michael, is training up these rural care coaches, these rural healthcare coaches. How does that work?
Yeah, and I'll defer to Tim after I give my little spiel here. But basically, this is a really a Mayo-centered initiative to figure out a different way to deliver healthcare to rural settings. I think what Mayo learned during the pandemic was that much of healthcare can be delivered remotely through telehealth. But perhaps what was missing was someone embedded in the community who can help with the communication between the patient and the provider. And I think this care coach or this community healthcare worker initiative is really going to provide that person who's embedded in the community that can really assist with that two-way communication between the patient and the provider.
And in this communication, Dr. Nelson, some of this communication used to be handled solely by the provider, by the physician or the nurse having a conversation with their patient, getting to know them, ensuring they understand what's happening, what are the next steps. Do you envision these care coaches handling more of this relationship work?
Yeah, it's a great question, and it's exactly what we're aiming to do. That as I grew up, my stepfather was the local physician in a rural community and got those calls 24/7. As we have lost our rural physicians and healthcare providers in the rural setting, we have created a void that has been dependent on technology, social media, other ways of getting information that our communities can trust. We need to fill that gap with people that are trained, competent, empowered to be the trusted partner for our communities. And we think this care coach model is a really unique, innovative way of bringing community healthcare workers to another skill level, to another skill set, more confident in their knowledge of healthcare and more connected to the healthcare providers, physicians, nurses in our hubs and our centers, and really building that community outreach that's embedded in communities to not replace the role of a physician, but to augment the patient-physician relationship that is so vital to protect and promote in our digital telehealth world.
We're talking with Dr. Tim Nelson of the Mayo Clinic Health System in Northwest Wisconsin, heading up research and innovation there. Michael Carney with us from UW-Eau Claire on strategic partnerships front. As we look at a workforce innovation grant, $9.4 million over 3 years, I want to circle back to partnerships, because partnerships between schools and healthcare organizations have been going on for a long time, Michael Carney. How do you evaluate whether a partnership is fruitful, whether it's working, whether it will be chipping away at this workforce shortage?
Well, I think when we evaluate the effectiveness of our partnership, specifically with Mayo Clinic, I think what we have found is that there is, and our leaders, our respective leaders like to talk about this, there is no daylight between us in terms of what our mission is, what our focus is, and how we can improve the lives and the careers of our students and community members in our region. So there, I think there truly is no daylight between the mission of Mayo Clinic and the mission of UW-Eau Claire. We have different clients, if you will. I mean, our clients are students. Mayo Clinic's clients are our patients. But in terms of education, research, and meeting the needs of our clientele, we have incredibly similar mission statements.
Okay, so in our moments left here, what are the next steps for this grant project? What rolls out next? Either of you can go here. I'm just curious, what are next steps?
Well, I think next steps is to to basically launch all of the initiatives that are in this grant. This is a multi-pillared, multifaceted grant. It's going to take incredible coordination, both on the university side and on the Mayo side. The wonderful part about this is that Tim and I have been working together for over 4 years now. So we already know a lot about each other. We know a lot about our respective organizations. So we don't have to go through that learning process in terms of figuring out how we're going to move this forward. We already know each other very well. We know our quirks because we're both parts of very large organizations. But I think one very important part of our collaboration is that our large organizations, the Mayo Enterprise and the UW System, have given us the opportunity to work together and separate from some of the bureaucracy in the two systems.
Thank you both for joining us. News Update is next on the Ideas Network. You're with us for the morning show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Now it's time for Wisconsin Life. Here's producer Carl Christensen with a story about how watching your parents dance as a child shapes the legacy you leave behind for your own children.
Have you ever been at a wedding and caught a glimpse of your parents slow dancing? Maybe you marveled, or maybe you cringed, but I'm willing to bet you felt something. Jan Larson shares a story about how watching her parents dance in the kitchen brought her comfort as a child, and now as a mother as she watches her children forge their own affections.
The legacy parents leave their children isn't always easy to spot. On those rare occasions when we get a glimpse of something good, it is oh so sweet. As a child, I delighted in my father's nightly ritual. He would sneak up on my mother as they cleared away the dinner table or wiped down the countertops, and what was our kitchen transformed into their private ballroom dance floor. I only have eyes for you. He crooned tenderly as he wrapped his arms around her, his face nestled into that space along the back of her neck and shoulder. Gently, he twirled her around, ignoring her mock protests, and swept her into his arms in a glide across the linoleum floor. The moment was brief, enchanting, and one that left a young child certain of her parents' love. All was right with the world. Some years later, I met and married my own darling. And then, one night while tidying the kitchen, I felt his arms wrap around me, hands turning me to face him as he guided me in our own dance across the hardwood floor. Happy tears pricked at my eyes as he twirled me, pulled me close, and then finished with the big dip. As toddlers, our children squealed with pleasure at Daddy's strength and the light in Mom's eyes. As teens, they offered eye rolls, shoulder shrugs, and the predictable, get a room, to which we replied, we have a license, marriage that is, to do this. But underneath the playful teasing, our children too were certain of their parents' love. And again, all was right with the world. Not too long ago, our eldest son stopped in for a Saturday brunch. As logs crackled in the fireplace and music filled our home, I busied myself in the kitchen. The little boy who once reached up to me, now a young man, put his hands on my shoulders and turned me to face him, pulling me toward him for his own dance. As we swayed to the music, he looked down. I want to be like you, he said. Stunned, my response was brutally honest. Why? He tossed his head back in a brief laugh. I just do. All my mistakes, all my flaws flashed through my mind. This would not do. I did not want to waste the moment. But what to say? Take the good but leave the rest, I fairly pleaded. Another light laugh. Okay, Mom. I realize now I don't need to fear for my son. He knows my flaws, yet finds reason to love. Perhaps in following his father's example, taking our dance and making it his own, he already has claimed the best we have to offer. If the legacy of children being certain of love is what we leave behind, then sweet is the knowledge that all will be right with the world.
Jan Larson is a journalist and professor at UW-Eau Claire. Wisconsin Life is a co-production of Wisconsin Public Radio and PBS Wisconsin in partnership with the Wisconsin Humanities Council. Additional support comes from Lowell and Mary Peterson of Appleton. Find more Wisconsin Life at wisconsinlife.org and on Facebook. I'm Carl Christensen.
And now we explore our state's recent gay history and the LGBTQ pioneers who fought oppression and made progress in gay rights, changing the narrative, living openly with gay pride. One of Wisconsin's pioneers passed away last week. Dick Wagner was the first openly gay member of the Dane County Board of Supervisors. He co-chaired the Wisconsin Governor's Council on Lesbian and Gay Issues, the first in the nation. Dick was on our show in February to discuss his book called Coming Out, Moving Forward. And much of the research for this more than 600-page volume came from his extensive personal archives. We wanted to revisit that conversation in memory of Dick, who came on the Ideas Network numerous times. And let's start where Dick talked about traveling across the state for the Governor's Council in the 80s to understand how the gay community was doing.
We found initially a great deal of timidity in that gays had not been part of the public discussion in most communities around the state. And so the Governor's Council would go in, and from the Governor's office we would invite various local officials, particularly some law enforcement folks, sheriffs and police chiefs, and then also social services folks from often county governments to come and meet with us and to also meet with members of their local LGBT community and have conversations that they'd never had before about how they interacted and what services the community should expect and could request on behalf of their rights as citizens.
Did you find that there were pockets or kind of some uneven issues that you saw around the state where people were accepted, other places where they just had a lot of issues, like in Superior?
Most places they had a lot of issues. There were very few places in the 70s and 80s that they were accepted. There was beginning to be some in Milwaukee and Madison, but even in Milwaukee they had Police Chief Breyer used to raid gay establishments and harass gays in the town. And so gay folks over there joined with women's folks who were concerned about how he approached rape issues and the African-American community to get rid of Chief Breyer, signed to the kind of coalition building that the LGBT community was very good at in this period.
Dick, you wrote that the Stonewall riots of 69 have assumed a mythic place in gay history and are surrounded by other myths. What do we not understand about Stonewall?
Well, Stonewall's become a political marker. President Obama used it to talk about Seneca Falls, Selma, and Stonewall with great alliteration about sites that specifically marked liberation movements. But in Volume 1, I really talked about how a fair number of Wisconsinites liberated themselves by affirming their identity and forming support networks even before Stonewall. And some of those people continued to become involved with the community after Stonewall. But you really did get a whole new bunch of activists motivated by Stonewall across the country, and they interacted with each other. In 1971, the Madison Gay Center hosted a national conference at the Memorial Union, and in 1972, GPU hosted the Midwest Homophile Conference. And so Wisconsin was trying to be in the leadership of this new movement and referenced back to the sense of fighting back against the oppression, which was the symbol of the Stonewall riots, when the gay bar patrons in New York fought back against police trying to close them down.
And as you mentioned, Obama, many LGBT activists refer to Stonewall as this catalyst for change. U.S. Senator Tammy Baldwin, who wrote the foreword to your book, spoke about this around the 50th anniversary.
Along with public protests in Chicago, Los Angeles, New York, Philadelphia, San Francisco, Washington, D.C., and elsewhere, the Stonewall uprising became a catalyst for the LGBTQ civil rights movement to secure social and political equality and inspired the formation of many advocacy organizations.
So did you feel that ripple effect here in Wisconsin?
Oh, yes. Stonewall happens in June in 69, and in the fall of 69, the Madison Alliance for Homosexual Equality meets, and then the GPU folks, Gay People's Union in Milwaukee, start to organize a little bit in the fall, but more in the spring of 1970. And Stonewall was clearly a signal to both of those groups of individuals that they needed to do something more and that they should organize. They were taking steps that were, you know, brave and bold at the time. Chuck Bauer, Chuck Beckwith were part of those people who joined the early Madison Alliance for Homosexual Equality. And they recalled sort of the trepidation going around the block sort of to enter St. Francis House where the first meetings were held. So there was a lot of courage, but there was still a sense of an imperative. You had to do this for your own sense of liberation and self.
We're revisiting a conversation about Wisconsin's recent gay history with author, activist, and pioneer Dick Wagner, who passed away last week. And in February, we talked about his book, spotlighting these events and milestones from Wisconsin's LGBTQ community in the post-Stonewall era between 69 and 2000. We'll pick this up back in just a minute on the Ideas Network. It's the morning show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. We're revisiting a conversation about Wisconsin's recent gay history in memory of author and activist Dick Wagner, who passed away last week. Dick last came on our program in February to talk about his new volume of work, shining a light on Wisconsin's LGBTQ community in the second half of the 20th century. And he writes, LGBT residents did the improbable. They found their voices, claimed their spaces, and dared to speak the truth. And in the process, they built community. The book is called Coming Out, Moving Forward. Let's pick up the conversation where Savannah from Ashland joined to urge more education on the science of homosexuality and the transgender community.
So you mentioned before the break that you had a question of what needs to happen to continue advocacy for the LGBTQ community in Wisconsin. And I think that we need to continue to have or have more medical and science professionals advocating and speaking out to break down ignorance that there are more than two genders and that heterosexuality is not the only norm, but rather it's a spectrum. And we need to stop the bigotry that's coming out of some legislators like MTG who put up, you know, signs that say male or female, it's the science. That's not the science. We need to get the science out and we need to educate people so that they can understand homosexuality and transsexuality as well.
Savannah, thank you. Dick, how can history inform moving the science forward today?
Well, the science goes way back. The sexuality in the human male, which was brought out by Kinsey in 1947, was the book that really sort of ripped the veil across ignorance and showed that there was a large number of sexual variants. He had a scale of 1 to 6, and that people could be fluid across that scale. But people often don't want to learn, and so that's been one of the challenges throughout LGBTQ history is to how to present their own authentic voices and get people to listen to them. And so that's a lot of what our history is. When I was growing up in schools, there was no LGBT history at all, and so part of my effort was to change that silence about our history. And say there's a whole lot out there that we need to know about if we're talking about Wisconsin.
Well, can you point to any events or moments in this history how activists could counter misinformation?
They countered it by doing their own lives and own stories. And I have a whole chapter on LGBT media, and that was important that they created those outlets for telling those stories. They also sent out early speakers to high schools. One of Madison's high schools invited some of those UW-Madison campus speakers to come, and the principal shut it down. Feeling that that was wrong, Judy Greenspan, who was one of those invited speakers, decided that she would run for the school board to try and change that policy. And in 1973, I think she was probably the first out lesbian in the nation to run for elective office. She ran pretty well in parts of the city, but not enough to get her elected to the school board. But as a candidate for the school board, she was able to speak in those very high schools that she had been denied the right to speak as an LGBT person.
In 2019, Governor Evers declared the gay pride flag would fly over the Capitol and state buildings for the first time during Pride Month in June. And Milwaukee transgender activist El Halo spoke about the dangers that black transgender women face.
We know what it is to live each day where even a simple errand can become a tragic instance of violence.
What is the inception here for gay pride events, for coming out events, for gay parades? Where do you see that?
Well, they were very important to the community from the first. The Madison Alliance for Homosexual Equality in 1970 had May Day, which was a whole series of gay pride events around campus, and things only grew from there. Pride Fest in Milwaukee became one of the largest celebrations in the state, but there have been, prior to COVID, a whole series of gay pride events all around Wisconsin that have grown and have showcased local communities. And that's important for self-affirmation as well as for visibility on the broader scale, bringing the rainbow flags and other symbols of liberation. Is another way that people try and present themselves to the larger community.
We're revisiting a conversation about Wisconsin's recent gay history with activist and author Dick Wagner, who passed away last week. Dick came on our program in February with his book, Coming Out, Moving Forward. Let's get back to the conversation now with Ricardo from Madison, who called in.
So I'd just like to comment that Dick brought a really good point that made me realize about the marches or the rallies that happened on May Day. Because here in Madison, on May 1st, people from the undocumented community rally at the Capitol about identity issues, right? About coming out. Because, yeah, we are coming out of the shadows from this identity, about things about immigration issues. And so I would like to learn more about the May Day because it is about identity issues, and I would like to see them come together because we are coming out from the shadows. So I just really wanted to point that out, and I want to learn more.
Ricardo, thank you so much for your call. Dick, what about the May Day marches and the broader conversations around identity?
Well, part of the timing of May Day back in 1970 was because it had a lot of campus support, and so they wanted to do something before the students were gone for the summer. And so rather than wait for June and the Stonewall anniversary, they did something in May. But May Day had a traditional rallying point going back to the early labor movement and the international movements for rights for workers. And so part of that was sort of a felicitous choice. But the caller is right. There needs to be much more stories told about how immigrants have contributed to our society. I know I come from folks who came from Germany for the most part. So many of us have stories of immigration that have enriched this country, and we need to sort of stop demonizing the immigrants to this country and celebrate their contributions. That's one of the things that the early gay community was also saying is stop criminalizing us, stop making us feel like we're sick and outside. Instead, understand what we bring to the table when we share our stories and acknowledge who we are.
Dick, I want to make sure that we talk about Mary Fran Tryon, who was administrator of the Equal Rights Division at the time that the non-discrimination statute was put into effect. Mary charged with enforcing it. What was she like?
She was a very powerful African-American woman, and she was committed to the equal rights effort in the state. And because Wisconsin was a leader in this, she would go out and speak to other state legislatures and tell them, look, this can work. Wisconsin is showing it can work. It was almost a decade after Wisconsin passed its non-discrimination law before another state became joining us in that effort. So she really was an early advocate and pioneer. She realized that she had to retrain her staff to deal with this new basis for complaints on equal rights. And she did that. And she also insightfully observed that if you're a woman or if you're an African American, when you file a complaint, the basis for your complaint is pretty obvious. But if you were filing a complaint on sexual orientation, you also had to come out as to who you were. So it wasn't just that you were filing a complaint, but that you were publicly in a public document declaring your sexual orientation. And so she felt this required some extra sensitivity on the part of the equal rights staff as to how to enforce this new law. So she was one of the real champions in the story.
Another champion that I want to make sure we make space for, U.S. Senator Tammy Baldwin. How does her story fold into this era?
Oh, Tammy's a remarkable person. I met her early in her county board career. I was able to sort of help her along the way with some good appointments to finance committee and things like that, as well as setting her up to head the Dane County AIDS Task Force. And she was able to use her leadership efforts in those things to launch her state assembly campaign and then to go on to win a seat in the U.S. Congress. But she's been a remarkable advocate for the community, an example of leadership and the kind of response that can be provided for the whole nation.
With people like Baldwin or anyone else who is openly gay, what impact did that have on their running for office?
For the most part, it helped gain some support because they were authentic about who they were when they told their own personal stories. And that authenticity is something that was prized by voters.
And that was activist and author Dick Wagner with his book Coming Out, Moving Forward, the book built on his first volume chronicling Wisconsin's early gay history leading up to the Stonewall riots. We spoke in February. Dick Wagner died last week at age 78. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. You're listening to The Morning Show here on the Ideas Network.